Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon sponsor of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, just check out the link below or go to our official website, bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and you'll see the link in the upper right-hand corner. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we are doing our last end-of-the-year review that we do every year on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. If you're new to the show, we go back 30 years, 40 years, and 50 years at the beginning of each new year, and we look back at the history of bodybuilding and all the different events that took place that year in the world of bodybuilding, all the major competitions, the competitors, etc. So this last year was 2023. So we went back 30 years back to 1993, 40 years back to 1983, and 50 years back to 1973. We even did one show where we went back to 1963. So we started, of course, with 1963, 73, 83, and then this will be our last report of 1993. In the last couple of weeks, we talked about the top amateur shows from 1993, including the MPC USA and the MPC Nationals. And then last week on the show, we talked about some of the big professional competitions in 1993, including the Arnold Classic and the Ironman Invitational, both won by Flex Wheeler, and the Night of the Champions won by Porter Cottrell. So on this show, we are going to talk about the big one of the year, which was the Mr. Olympia, of course. It took place in Atlanta, Georgia, and this was Dorian Yates' second victory in the Mr. Olympia contest. And on today's show, we have, again, Jerry Branum, our favorite guest. Jerry is always with us on all these end-of-the-year review shows, and he gives his insights because Jerry was a writer for Muscle and Fitness magazine and for Flex magazine, and then he became a writer later on for Ironman magazine. So he got to see a lot of these competitions and interview a lot of these competitors. But we've also got another very special guest on the show today, and that's Sean Ray. Sean was one of the top bodybuilders in the late 1980s, early 1990s. He was one of the most consistent and top-level bodybuilders in that era. In fact, Sean took the top, he placed in the top five at the Mr. Olympia for 12 consecutive years. And I don't think that has ever happened before, probably will never happen again. So an amazing physique, Sean Ray, definitely one of the best physiques really in the history of bodybuilding, and also a fantastic poser as well. So Sean is still actively involved in the sport of bodybuilding. He has been since he retired in 2001. And he is joining us on the show today to talk about his impressions of the 1993 Mr. Olympia. So Sean was in third place at this contest in 1993, a very close third place, right behind Flex Wheeler, who was in second place and was really close between Sean and Flex. So he's going to talk about that on our podcast today. And Sean started his run of the top five placings for 12 years in 1990 when he took third place. That was at the Chicago, where they had the very first drug-tested Mr. Olympia. And then the next year, Sean dropped down to fifth place. That was the year he won the Arnold Classic. And then the following year, when it was in Helsinki, Finland in 1992, Sean got fourth place. And so this year, he moved up another spot to third place. So it's going to be really interesting hearing Sean's observations from being actually in the contest and this point in his career, where he was and what he was hoping to achieve. So we got a really interesting interview with Sean Ray and Jerry Branum coming up in a minute. All right. We didn't get any emails from this last week. I do want to say happy birthday to both Dave Palumbo and Jim Mannion, who both celebrated their birthday on the 17th of February. I'm not sure how old Dave is, but I know Mr. Mannion turned 80 years old. And he looks fantastic for 80 years old. So Jim Mannion, if you're not aware, was the one who started the MPC back in 1982. And he is really responsible for where the sport is today as far as how far it has grown and where it has come. So an amazing task done by Jim Mannion. So happy birthday to him. He looks fantastic. They had a big party for him out in Pittsburgh. And Dave Palumbo also celebrating his birthday last weekend on the 17th. So happy birthday to both Dave and Jim. All right. When we get done with our interview with Jerry and Sean, I'm going to read an article which comes from the January 1994 issue of Flex Magazine. And this was the official Mr. Olympia report written by our good old friend Peter McGuff. Peter, of course, has passed away, but at the time, Peter was the senior writer for Flex Magazine, and he was a fantastic writer. We miss his great writing. So they had a really big report. Photography in this magazine was done by Chris Lund and Kevin Horton. Some great shots. And so I really want to read this article, which goes into depth about the 1993 Mr. Olympia. So I'll do that as soon as I get done with our interview with Sean Ray and Jerry Branum. All right, guys. Well, I hope you really enjoyed all these end of the year review shows we did. I think this is probably our seventh one, right? Because we did 1963, 73, 1983 was a two-parter, and 1993 was a three-parter. So I really enjoy doing these shows. It's great going back in history and looking at what happened 30, 40, and 50 years back in the sport. Kind of gives you some perspective of how great things were in some of these competitions back then, and how great some of these competitors were. So this will be our last one, and we'll go back to our regular interviews starting next week. I've got a few people on the docket that I want to interview. I just had a conversation with Rick Wayne again, and Rick said maybe we can do an interview this month. So keep your fingers crossed for that one. We got a lot to talk about with Rick still, even though we did a three-parter with him about a year and a half ago. You can believe it's been that long already. I told Rick maybe we could talk about Carl Weathers, who just recently passed away, Apollo Creed. Because Carl used to train at Vince's gym, and Rick knew him pretty well. So got a lot more stories, I'm sure, coming from Rick Wayne. So hopefully we can get him on the podcast in the next few weeks. So that would be fantastic. All right, guys, without any further ado, here's our interview with Sean Ray and Jerry Branum, where we talk about the 1993 Mr. Olympia. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have two special guests with me today. I have Jerry Branum, who's been joining us the last few weeks, talking about our year in review shows. And we also have our special guest, Sean Ray, who's we're going to talk about the 1993 Mr. Olympia on this episode. And Sean was, of course, a part of the 1993 Mr. Olympia. He took third place. I think that was your fifth Mr. Olympia, right, Sean?
Yeah, it was 88, 90. 91, 92, 93. So it was my fifth.
Yeah, I nailed it. All right. Well, of course, this contest was Dorian's second Mr. Olympia win. And Dorian was really improved this year. He was 257. He was 15 pounds heavier than the year before when he won it in Helsinki. And Sean, you moved up in the placings. You were in fourth place in 1992, and then you moved up to third place. And every year you moved up until you got to second. So tell us a little bit about the 93 Olympia going into it. You took the whole year off. I think you said, and I read some magazine reports, you and Dorian, I think, were the only two that trained specifically for the Olympia all year.
Yeah, so in 92, the last time the Mr. Olympia was held outside of the country of the United States, I'd flown to Finland. Dorian won his first Olympia. And, of course, Kevin Lavroni was making his debut and got second place. I was in a different headspace. I had John Little was in my ear and a few others after prejudging that I had nailed it. I'd improved significantly from 91, which was a busy year for me. I got this trophy behind me at the Arnold Classic in 91, slipped down to fifth place in 91 from third in 1990. But in Helsinki, Finland, I showed up significantly drier. And that was working to my favor, especially when I was up there by myself. We saw Vince Taylor had slipped from the 91 Olympia from third place. He was waterlogged. That's where he came on with the patch. Remember the patch, Jerry? Mm-hmm. It's the pirate ever since. He used to be this quiet storm. Then I switched his name to the pirate. But in 92, I'll use a word from the late Peter McGough. The synchronicity of my physique had arrived. I felt like I was as dry as I'd ever been. I saw some things that I hadn't displayed on my physique, especially from the back double bicep. I think that was my most improved pose. And in my mind, it was like, the Olympias are won from the back. And when I stand next to Labrada, he's going to feel this improvement. And unfortunately, I wound up in fourth place behind Labrada's third place. But I had my sights set on Labrada. I always felt if I could beat Labrada, I could be in the conversation. Because again, in 1990, he was second place.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1991, he was fourth and I was fifth. So Labrada was the guy I was going to beat. Arguably, I kind of had a sense that Dorian was going to be the man to beat coming off second in 1991 at the Olympia. But in 92, Dorian won. So now we're into 1993. And here's my chance. Come in and beat Labrada, who I thought if I beat Labrada, I'm going to be in the Olympia conversation again. But I'd love to get Kevin Lavrone in my rearview mirror, right? And that was, I think, the year that Kevin Lavrone tore his pec.
Yeah, in January. Yeah.
Tore his pec, and I was there training with Lex Wheeler for the 93 Arnold Classic. I had a taste of victory. He witnessed, you know, that victorious win and shared in some fun with me. And when he won the 1993 Arnold Classic, I felt like I won the 93 Arnold Classic because I trained with him. Hmm. I saw him suffer. Lex Wheeler suffers for bodybuilding shows more than any other bodybuilder you'll ever know, because he's got to do some drastic last minute shit that none of us are willing to do. Flex would be doing 3 hours of cardio, training twice a day.
Why is that, Sean? Was he cheating on his diet or what?
Yeah, he wasn't very good with his diet. He would do the work when he's there, but it was like slave labor for him. If you go back and look at those Battle for the Olympias that Mitsuru Okabe used to make, you know, I'd roll up in my Mercedes or whatever car I was driving that year, but I would drive into those gym workouts like, I'm ready for war. I'm going to battle. Mm-hmm. Like whoever's waiting for me on the other side of the gym, we're going to war. And Flex Wheeler didn't have that same tenacious attitude. And I felt it in 93 training for that Arnold Classic, because he would get there and suck all the oxygen out of the room. Mm-hmm. As good as he was, and I knew he was going to be good, he would suck the oxygen out of the room at every one of those workouts. So training that close to the enemy would allow me to get into his head a little bit, some of the psychology. And I would take the lack of energy he had and I would use it when I got up there. I figured if he would copy me, he would be that much better. And I would drag him through. I'd make sure, and Enrico and Chris and whoever else, we were on the Flex Wheeler bandwagon in 93, knowing I would have to face this guy on the Olympia stage. But if I could out-train this guy while he's training for the Arnold, I knew I could maybe surpass him on the Olympia stage just because I needed to outwork him. He would win the 1993 Olympia, and arguably I'd never seen a physique like that up close and personal change so much in my lifetime. And when that Arnold Classic was done in 1993, I felt like it was going to be a two-man show between me and Dorian. I thought I was going to leapfrog because I outworked Flex, and Flex just won. Like some people were telling me I should have gone in the 93 Olympia based on how I looked off-season because of how hard we were training to get Flex ready for that show. So I had a running start in March of 93 to go into the Olympia. And I was sprinting to the Olympia. I had vengeance on my mind. I wanted to get Labrada, put him in my rearview mirror. And if I could do that, I'd be one of the last men standing. Along the way, Flex was busy. He would win four shows in 1993. Mm-hmm. He was named of the year. And then he would show up at the Olympia, and he just had this momentum. All the magazines were out. Flex was on the covers. Flex, 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 Flex. And I was coming from fourth place at the Olympia in 92. Kevin, I don't think Kevin even made it to the stage, did he, in 93?
Yeah, he was fifth.
That's how the pec tear really held him back. But I knew it was going to be me, Labrada, Flex, and Dorian. Those were going to be the last four guys standing.
What did you think of Flex's physique? Because everybody was raving about Flex, how he looked at that 93 Arnold. In fact, even today, like 30 years later, people are still saying that was one of the best physiques ever in bodybuilding. What was your opinion of how he looked?
That came from me originally. I mean, listen, I'm a fan of bodybuilding first. And Flex Wheeler was everything I wanted to be at the 93 Olympia. I don't think he ever superseded that physique. It got bigger.
Yeah.
It got uglier. It got suspicious over the years. I don't think it got better, in my opinion. Even though Flex went on to get second place, I think three times in the Olympia, and he won a couple more Arnold Classics. But in 93, at that time, I'd never seen anything like it. Okay, so you're only as good as the people you stand next to. And that Arnold Classic lineup was not the Olympia lineup. Who got second place that year?
At the Arnold?
Yeah.
Labrada.
So for me, that's how forgettable it was, because it was Flex Wheeler from the start.
Yeah, but Flex dominated.
Yeah, so Kevin beat me in 92. Flex just wins the Arnold in 93. Am I going to go backwards? I got to get Labrada. So I was training for the 93 Olympia just hoping, and because Labrada was comparable to me.
Yeah.
Not knowing that Kevin would get injured or hurt, but I felt like that would be a small victory. But now Flex is going to be in the mix. Am I going to go backward? So I took that offseason training in 93 from March, and I put it into overdrive. And I got to tell you, and Jerry, you might, I don't know, if you had seen me up until that point, I saw things on my physique in 93 that I didn't see in 1992. And I was cocksure this was going to come down to me and Dorian Yates. When I hit my back double biceps, my glutes were great like Aspari back in 1988. We hadn't seen that. My Christmas tree was much more pronounced. I had better control over my poses except my front double bicep, which happened to be Flex Wheeler's best shot. I still hadn't mastered my vacuum. I still hadn't mastered the control of my midsection in that front double bicep. And that was – that looked like the USA Trophy looked like Flex Wheeler posing for it.
Right.
Flex's front double bicep was second to none. I mean, Dorian, I didn't even see Dorian doing it.
Right.
But in my completeness, in my preparation, I didn't think I could have been, and I don't think I ever was, as dry as I was in 1993. Flex was fuller, rounder, thicker, curvier. He had everything that I didn't have, and he had the hype on me. And I think he was the natural comparison to Dorian. And when I got third place in that contest, it wasn't a bittersweet third place. It was a humongous victory in my economy by beating legend Lee Labrada, because that's all I wanted. So I couldn't complain about Flex being soft in the hamstrings or in the glutes, which was my strong point. And knowing that when the back double bicep came, Flex arguably looks better in the back double bicep.
But
from the bottom of my feet to the base of my neck, I was harder than Flex was. But Flex had me in the rear double bicep. And I think they overlooked his soft hamstrings, his soft glutes, which was his Achilles heel.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt very good after getting third place because I knew I still had a little bit of work to do. I got Labrada. I felt like I could exhale. And losing to Flex in that year was not a slap in the face. And, of course, I conceded to Dorian because I thought he was a bigger, better version than he was in 1992.
Right. Well, I remember in 92, that was the Helsinki contest, right?
Yeah.
I remember, Sean, you were particularly annoyed about what happened there. I remember outside, your brother looked like he wanted to slug somebody. I still remember how pissed you were, really pissed off about that contest in 92.
Yeah, I didn't understand it, Jerry, because I'm always of the opinion that the most complete guy should win. I wasn't bummed about Dorian. Dorian just it was a natural progression after what he did next to Haney in 91.
Right.
Like, he's got to stand next to Haney. But I thought, you know, Kevin was a little overspent from the Night of Champions. He looked long in the torso. His color was very fair. It was like it wasn't even tan. It didn't do him any favors under those bright lights. And I also thought that he was very narrow in the rear double back bicep. That's where Kevin was his weakest.
Right.
His two strongest poses was his most muscular pose that he did often.
Yeah.
And his side chest. And I thought, you know, those are only two poses. I think his rear lat spread wasn't all that impressive. His rear double back bicep, he was very exposed. If you could find a picture of me and Kevin doing a rear double back bicep in that show, I had him on the ropes. But again, I was more perturbed that Labrada beat me again than I was that Dorian won. And I think that you have to have that in you. You have to have that venom of being pissed off to get better the following year.
Yeah.
Which it did propel me to get better in 1993, the first time it was held in Atlanta, Georgia. And, you know, I was highly driven and highly motivated. Lee Haney was going to be in the house. I was coming to Atlanta for the first time since the 1985 Teen Nationals. That's where I wanted at. That's where I arrived. Bodybuilding scene, but my sole mission going into the 93 Olympia really was to get Lee Labrada and get that feather in my cap, because I honestly believe that he was the best little bodybuilder next to Muhammad Mekawe and Muhammad Benaziza, and I wanted to be that guy. So it was a small milestone for me, but I felt like I outconditioned Flex Wheeler in 93, and I had a strong case for second place.
Well, you were really, really disappointed that you lost to Flex, right, Sean, at that 93 Olympia?
I was, because I knew things about the preparation for the show that the fans weren't privy to, right?
Yeah.
Flex was really lazy. I watched him phone it in. I watched him miss workouts. I watched him cheat on his diet. He's just such a genetic freak, man, that somehow or another he creates this illusion with his full muscle bellies of being complete. And I was just thinking, you know, there's things in my deltoids, there's things in my serratus, my glutes, my hamstrings. There were things I was seeing on myself because I was disciplined and I was doing the work in the gym, that having this information, you know, there's a little bit of resentment because it just, it was easy for him. So for me, it was easy to be upset with him, but also to think that the judges don't see this. He's soft.
Yeah.
He's smooth. He's soft. He's smooth. But when he actually flexes in certain poses, he's able to hide some of that.
Right.
He's able to hide some of that. From the rear, it's harder to hide, but his back double bicep was so impressive that his narrow lat spread was overlooked. His hamstrings and glutes, like Lee Priest, were very weak. And they overlook that aspect of the game. And I was really hyper-focused on that aspect of the game. And it takes a lot out of you to get those ripped glutes, to get those ripped hamstrings, and to, you know, be as dry as you can possibly be. So I felt like I outworked Flex, and I didn't feel like I got rewarded for that.
You think it was the momentum of him winning those four pro shows earlier in the year that maybe got him into second by a lot of the judges?
But listen, without a doubt. I mean, yeah. You couldn't pick a magazine and not read that Flex Wheeler was going to be the next Mr. Olympia. Hell, I was telling people Flex was going to be the next Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
So it's hard to be upset with Flex. Easier for me to be upset with the system because I figured the judges won't give him a pass. Mm. But pose for pose, pound for pound, I felt like I outworked him and I outconditioned him, but there really wasn't the reward waiting for me that I expected. But beating Lee Labrada softened the blow.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, Sean, do you feel that if Flex had put a little more effort into the training and diet, he could have gotten, let's say, the harder looking glutes and the let's say the parts that you said he looked soft in? Or is it a genetic thing where he just couldn't get it like that? I mean, was it because of his laziness or was it some sort of genetic thing? What do you think?
You know, if the 1993 Arnold Classic had been the 1993 Mr. Olympia, Flex Wheeler would have been Mr. Olympia. I call Flex
really?
Mr. March.
Hmm.
I call him Mr. March because he always peaks in March, right? Hmm. And by the time the Olympia comes around, you've got all these appearances. You relax because you spent everything that you got getting ready for that show in March. It's hard to ramp it. I know because I did the Arnold three times. And peaking in March and trying to peak in September is really a difficult task. That's why I take my hat off to Jay Cutler. You know, he won it three times in a row and was second three times in a row at the Arnold. Very few people are able to do that. Ronnie Coleman, Brandon Curry, Dexter Jackson, they were able to do it. Flex, on the other hand, couldn't really replicate the September look that he presented in March. And I think it has a lot to do with the things that come with winning. The weight of the crown is heavy when you're the champion coming off a victory in March and everyone wants you to go to this country, that country. You know, he has kids, buying cars, he's enjoying the victory. Now it's time to do it all again and suffer in the summertime. And you run out of gas by the time the Olympia comes. And so Flex's placings on the Olympia stage go all the way down to eighth place. Mm. You know, he's fluctuating eighth, he's second, he's fifth. I mean, he was all over the map.
Yeah.
For me, I think I got a little bit more consistency being in that top five for 12 years because that was my focus, was just peaking that one time. But arguably, if you put that Olympia in March of 93, I'm not sure Dorian wins.
Wow. Even with the 15-pound added muscle, huh?
Well, as good as Dorian was in Helsinki, Finland, he'll tell you, he was flawed. He was thin. Dorian was thin. He lost a lot of weight from 91 because he knew he wasn't competing against Haney.
Yeah.
He knew he was going to be competing against guys that were smaller and maybe even more conditioned. But with it being in Europe, it might play to his advantage. It's a shorter trip from England over to Helsinki. I think he over-dieted. He didn't put the focus on his mass. And had he showed up in Columbus, Ohio in 93, Flex was – what can you criticize Flex for in 93? I had nothing. He had everything that he was missing as his career progressed. So that would have been a good, interesting battle. But
yeah, it would have.
For what it was, nobody really contested the 93 Olympia. I think a lot of the bodybuilders at one time or another have either been injured or they've been off. I was off in 91 when I got fifth place because I won the Arnold in 91 in March, and I just ran out of gas. I was guest posing 3 weeks up until the 91 Olympia. But what made that 93 Olympia special for me was obviously focusing on Librata and capturing Librata. And now I'm in the top three again. And it had been some time. People don't realize that 1990, I was third place. Then it was 91, and there was 92, and there was 93. It seemed like an eternity to get back into that top three. And for a bodybuilder, it changes the economy of your life, being in the top three.
Yeah.
Instead of just being a top Olympian. There's some perks and some rewards that you get for being there, and we have to earn it the hard way. And I suffered in 93 to try to hold on to the size and bring out some detail and learn how to perform my body. I needed to learn how to. I'm going up with Librata. I was there in 88 when Librata was he fourth, third place in 90, fourth place in 90, fourth. In 88.
Fourth, yeah.
Stood on stage with him. And arguably had one of the best posing routines I'd ever saw at that 88 Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a work of art. The 1988 Lee Librata was just on fire. So for me, having start my career looking at that's the guy I have to beat, dreaming of being Mr. Olympia, but there's one guy I got to catch. And then running him down and catching him and having that validation, it changed my financial end of business on the Olympia stage. It solidified that I was a certified, bona fide top three Olympian that could at some point have another bite at the apple and maybe stand on stage for the title. But now I had to turn my focus on flex and remind myself that Kevin Lafroni, even though injured, is still dangerous. He showed up and he got fit. It's not a career ending injury. And so Kevin was not going anywhere, and I knew he would come back and I'd have to battle with him. We're all the same age.
Yeah.
So when I take Dorian out of it, I can't get to Dorian unless I get through Flex and Kevin. And so it set the stage for 1994 and all the years to come after that by having Flex beat me in 1993. There was still that filled up my gas tank to go into 1994. So 93 was a pivotal year for me in a lot of ways, especially beating Lavroni on stage in head-to-head competition.
Yeah. This is the contest report from 93. I want to read what Peter McGuff wrote when you and Flex got second and third. So it said, just about every placing from 10th upward had been booed, but a howling cacophony of derision greeted Sean Ray's third place announcement. He shared the crowd's consternation and almost staggered as he turned his back toward the audience. For one fragile moment, it seemed as if he might walk off stage, and then Flex Wheeler intervened. Due to their conflict of 1993 Olympia interest, these bosom pals of a year ago had gradually seen less and less of each other to the point where they hadn't even spoken for 10 weeks. Now Flex grabbed Sean around the shoulders and held him for what seemed an age. Above the hubbub, he barked into his captive's ear, "You had me. They got it wrong. Keep your head. Don't walk off, okay?" Satisfied that Sean was receptive to the advice, Flex let his despondent rival go. The incident spoke volumes for Flex Wheeler's character, as it did for Sean's, and that his buddy found himself caring that much about him. So Flex told you that you had it.
Yeah, it was kind of a love-hate relationship. When I watched the rivalry between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, John Jones, and the UFC, the commentator, the black guy, I'm drawing a blank. Not Sugar Shane Rashad. One of the other guys he fought against.
I don't know UFC very well.
It'll come to me. I'm 58 years old now, John. when Flex embraced me, it was a relief because I that last 10 weeks. Remember, we trained for the Arnold Classic. Mm-hmm. It was gruesome, but it was something where it got me out of bed because I knew I was training with the winner. I knew Flex would win. And I knew I would have to beat him. When it came time for the Olympia in that summer, I didn't want to give him the energy. I knew I would carry Flex into that Olympia. And I did not want to use my energy to make him better when we're standing next to each other on that stage. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite sure had I trained with him for the Olympia the way I did the Arnold Classic, he probably could have won.
Wow.
I didn't want to, one, I wasn't on the payroll. I wasn't on the Flex Wheeler payroll. I got nothing. What I got was the satisfaction of kicking his ass on a regular basis. He will attest to that. Training wasn't his favorite thing to do. Me trying to make him quit and burn him out and do things that he didn't think he could do, that was victory for me every day while I was getting ready for the Arnold. I was not going to spend the summer of 93 giving him that for free. He would have been Mr. Olympia if I did that with him. I pulled away. So we didn't talk. When we got on that stage and he beat me anyways, that spoke volumes to the genetic structure that Flex has and that I acknowledge. I mean,
yeah,
beautiful physique. I mean, he got there through hard work. I don't want to take that away, but his genetics carried him into second place. He never outworked me in the gym. He'll tell you that. When I was announced third, he was relieved. I think he would not have felt any less if he was announced in third place because of the year that he had. He won the four shows, traveled the world. His bank account was full. He was competing with the world's best. Had we flipped places, he wouldn't have been surprised. I wasn't surprised when he wound up in third place either. So we respectfully, mutually, on that moment, accepted what was happening. And as I walked off the stage, I was like, I hope he beats Dorian, right? USA versus England. Yeah. I'm like, if Flex beats Dorian, it bodes well for me because I knew we were at a fork in the road. We're either going to go with mass or beauty.
Hmm.
And I was on the side of beauty. I was in the Flex Wheeler vernacular. I was nowhere in the Dorian Yates conversation station. It was going to be one or the other moving forward. So when Flex did not beat Dorian, of course, I wasn't happy, but Flex was very relieved. Flex was happy it was all over with. And not for nothing, me nor Flex ever warmed up to Dorian until we were all retired.
Yeah.
Dorian was always public enemy number one. We weren't friends. We weren't associates. But me and Flex had this Joe Frazier, George Foreman type rivalry where we respected each other's capabilities, but I was not cheering for him to beat me, for example. I once I was announced in third place, I felt like, you know what? You know, I threw a pity party for myself because I knew I worked harder than he did. Mm-hmm. But I had to accept the role of genetics, and he won. On any given day, he's genetically superior than most bodybuilders on the planet.
Yeah. That's interesting that you say that was the fork in the road, because that was the year that Dorian was bigger than we'd ever seen anybody. I mean, we had the Lee Haney era where Lee was bigger, so I guess you could say size won over a shape during Lee's era, but Lee had the small waist too. But yeah, eventually bodybuilding went the route of the mass monster. So that was probably the year, right? 1993, because you had Flex who had the great shape. You had the great shape. And then you had Dorian, who was bigger than ever. He was 257. I think the audience, from what I read, was in shock that year. So they went with the bigger. They could have went both either way, and they went with the size.
Yeah, I think people have to understand this misnomer is that Dorian didn't have the beautiful physique like Flex or Labrada or even Kevin, because Kevin could hide some of his flaws better than anybody in the business.
Yeah.
And all we're focused on the shoulders, we're focused on his arms, even his chest, even when it was torn. He didn't have the greatest legs, didn't have the greatest hamstrings, but he got in shape, Kevin did. With Dorian, we were all on a mission to stop this. We did not want bodybuilding to go this direction. Dorian allowed some bodybuilders that weren't of his cloth to flourish. Jean-Pierre Fuchs, Marcus Rule, Nasser El-Sembadi. These guys were becoming famous because they were comparable to Dorian. Mm. They weren't as good. They were not as good as Dorian, but they were his size. And so now you have a group of guys that are making guys with beautiful, shapely, conditioned physique almost invisible. Mm. That's why I lobbied so hard. Back in the day, the first thing you saw the Olympians do was do the symmetry round.
Yeah.
We all walked on stage. We did the symmetry round for 45 minutes to an hour before anyone ever struck a pose. I lobbied long and hard with Wayne D'Amelio and pounded this idea away that people pay money to see us look our best. Does it make sense for me to arrive backstage at the Olympia, dehydrated, go in the mirror and pump, put on all of this color, and then walk out there and stand up there for 45 minutes before I can do this? It makes no sense. The first thing that the fans see is one individual from the United States of America, Sean Ray. And I'm coming from backstage, pumping up, and I hit my mandatory poses by myself. And then everyone after that, by themselves. Now we can call out, based on what we saw, in order, the guys that we think are the best. Bring out the lineup, do the quarter turn, and bring the guys out. That did wind up changing. I don't remember what year it changed, but you'll notice at this upcoming Arnold Classic, that's the first thing you see, competitor number one. That happened because of me. Because standing there next to Gunther Schlierkamp, you know, Ronnie Coleman, Nasser, I'm tiny. And an hour into that, my muscles are not going to pop. None of our muscles are going to pop because they've deflated.
You're standing there. Yeah.
Yeah, we're focusing on trying to flex our quadricep for an hour before we actually pose our quads for the fans. So we smooth out. Mm. And that order did change. I forget what year it changed, but they understood the concept. But by Dorian winning, it started giving validation to the other bigger guys, and people wanted to see the bigger and bigger guys. And I knew along the way, Labrada, myself, Wheeler, we may not be able to last very long if they continually reward this look. As tragic as it was for Dorian's injury, we thought that would change the look of bodybuilding, and along comes Ronnie.
Yeah.
Well, Sean, I wanted to ask you something. You have to think about this. It's a long time. There was a press conference. You were on the DS. You know, Labrada was there. And I stood up. I asked you guys a question. I brought up the idea of having a lower weight class. I don't know whether I said 212, 200, something like that. They had that for a while. Then they got rid of it. And I asked you guys, I said, I'm directing a question at Sean Ray and Lee Labrada, because you guys have great quality physiques. I think it's kind of unfair that you have to compete against these guys at 40, 50 pounds, because it's very difficult for you to defeat them, because, you know, they're just bigger structured. You should have your own. And what surprised me, I don't remember if it was you or Labrada, one of them said it's not a good idea because it takes away from the prestige of the overall title. In retrospect, I mean, the fact that they created a couple of years later the 212 class, do you still believe it? What do you think?
I remember it well. That was me. And yeah. Years later, you're talking about the year 2005 when I promoted and put up the prize money for the very first 202 division in New York City. David Henry was running that show. That's it was right. Easy for me then to make that happen because I was retired and the smaller bodybuilders were getting overlooked simply for being smaller. But where I came from, at the time I was doing what I was doing, we were getting rewarded. We were being recognized. I mean, it's unfortunate that my career happened to come between three guys, Lee Haney, Dorian Yates, and Ronnie Coleman. They all share 22 consecutive years of holding the title of Mr. Olympia. And they're all three, shoulder to shoulder, eyeball to eyeball, almost pound for pound, with Lee Haney being the smallest at 250, Dorian 260, and Ronnie at 280. That was the direction that the sport was going. Don't feel sorry for me. Although I didn't beat any of those big guys, I beat Ronnie Coleman for many years before he actually won. Dorian, when he arrived, and rightfully, arguably so, won some Olympias that were controversial. Lee Haney with Dorian, with Gaspari and Labrada nipping at his heels. I don't think there was much controversy there with his. With no. Ronnie Coleman, Jay Cutler's probably the only one that has an argument during his reign, I believe in 2001. But let's just say these are our champions for those three for 22 consecutive years. It didn't matter. I didn't win at 210, 205 pounds. But neither did Kevin Lebroni at 245. Neither did Nasser El-Sabahi at 285. Nobody won. So that argument for me didn't wash because I beat Nasser. I beat Kevin. I beat all the other bigger guys during my reign. What was happening in my retirement is there were no little bodybuilders beating any of the bigger guys. You would have never heard of Flex Lewis. You'd have never heard of Kevin English. You would have never heard of David Henry, Guy Cisternino, Sean Clarita now. I mean, those guys would be obsolete if we just stuck to the open bodybuilding, because Sean Clarita is not going to beat these guys that Hadi Chupan, Samson Dauda, the guys that have come behind. When I retired, it was Ronnie Coleman for four more years. But the little guys that created a career for themselves, it'd be questionable if you think Flex Lewis could beat Jay Cutler. I don't think so. I mean, so now that the 212 exists, there's a little niche that they can choose and find a way to be famous in their own right, the same way the wheelchair camp champion can, the same way our women's physique champion can. If we don't have the splintering of women's bodybuilding, we don't have women's physique. We don't have women's figure. We don't have women's fitness. So all of those things that splintered and gave birth to now 11 IFBB Pro League divisions have created not only businesses, but careers for these other athletes, multiple champions. I believe Sid Gillen has won 6 or 7 Miss Figure champions.
Yeah.
Right? We have the Miss Women's Physique is going back and forth between Natalia and the girl from Texas.
Yeah. Sarah.
And Sarah. And now the 212, you know, Sean Clarita 1 year, and you got our other guy, Keon Pearson. So these titles are – it's making our sport interesting, whereas with the Mr. Olympia as of late, we could see a new Mr. Olympia this year. I mean, that title is very slippery. It seems like every year that Mr. Olympia crown is going to different people, and it could potentially wind up in England.
Yeah.
Right? It could go back to Iran. It could stay right here in America. I mean
– Although you do have now Derek, who won 212, and he won the Open. So maybe they're looking at it a little differently now than they were when you were in – Labrada were competing, but now you do have guys from 212 who can move, who can be competitive in the Open.
Well, to Jerry's point, there's a time and there's a season. They got rid of the 202, which I started.
Yeah.
For a reason, it just became obsolete, so they upped the weight.
212.
I think we're at a place in this era where the 212 can be obsolete because we have 212 bodybuilders that can compete with these guys. Derek
yeah.
Lunsford is living proof. His first Olympia. He was second place. His yeah. second Olympia came Mr. Olympia. Sean Clarita went and won the Reno Pro Show, an open contest, and beat Cedric McMillan, who yeah. won the Arnold. I think we're at a place in time right now, Jerry, where we don't need the 212 anymore. We can consolidate and take that prize money from the 212 and put it into the open category, assimilate the 212 bodybuilders into the open Olympia. It's a crowded yeah. field. But make the qualifications a little bit harder. Our 212 guys shouldn't be categorized. I was never categorized when I was competing. They weren't saying that I was the best 212 bodybuilder. They were saying I was one of the best bodybuilders, bar none, period.
Yeah.
There was no categorization of it. And I think that we are at a place in our bodybuilding industry where a guy like Sean Clarita in an open Olympia can beat some of these guys much bigger than he is, the same way that I did, the same way I believe Keon Pearson can. But that will never happen unless that division is gone the way of the A-track. And we didn't lose a step when the 212 disappeared. Our sport hadn't suffered. If you're a champion, you're going to be a champion regardless. I think some of our 212 are just as good, if not better, than a lot of our open bodybuilders. Derek Lunsford is case in point.
Yeah. Going back to that 93 Olympia, Sean, what did you think of Dorian? Because, you know, he really set a new standard, gaining all that size. I didn't see that contest in person. So what was your impression of him seeing him in person on stage?
No, I mean, I think, again, people are going to choose which year Dorian was at his best.
Mm-hmm.
But the gains from 92 to 93, for me watching him, were the most impressive.
Yeah.
You know, I've always said you have to be a fan or a historian to appreciate what people are able to do with their body. I didn't really have any critique for 93. I said at the beginning of this show, the guy with the fewest flaws should win. I'm not a fan of Dorian's physique, but I didn't think anybody was going to beat him on that day. Now you start moving up, you get into 94 and 95 and 96. You can start to cherry pick the areas that Dorian had issues, had problems that were suspect. But in 1993, I mean, he was put together. And yeah. there was nothing for me to criticize, which is why take my focus off the champion and go for the things I think I have control over. I have control over potentially beating Labrada. I have control over potentially beating Flex. Dorian's the winner. So I got to find what breadcrumbs I could. And those were the two major focal points I had as I discounted Kevin because he was coming back from his injury.
So looking at bodybuilding as a whole, like what's important, what should be judged? Of course, we got the size, and Dorian was the leader in that at that time. But you've also got symmetry, you've got proportion, you've got conditioning, definition, you got posing ability. Do you think Dorian should have won any more Olympias after he tore his bicep? Because I've heard his argument is that, well, I only lost the front double bicep pose, but I win all the other mandatories, or I win most of the other mandatories. But just looking at it from a perspective of, you know, this is physical ideal. This is, you know, Mr. Olympia. This is the best in the world. Do you think a guy should win Mr. Olympia when he's got a torn muscle group like that?
Yeah, I personally don't. And Dorian's heard that from me in person on the same Diaz as we're talking. I think deep down in his economy, he probably would agree with that. But mm-hmm. since he's a benefactor of the judges rewarding him, overcompensating in areas that you know, they're not being, it's not being scored evenly. Yeah, you have the best back. You got great calves. You got, you know, an enormous lat spread, but now we can start to pick apart the things that, you know, used to be near and dear. 93, he was flawless. 94, where do we start?
Yeah.
90, you know, I mean, I firmly believe after the 94 Olympia, or I should say starting with the 94 Olympia, mm-hmm. that I should be Olympia. I believe that Kevin could have been Mr. Olympia, and I believe that Nasser El-Sambadi should have been Mr. Olympia during Dorian's reign.
Right.
So I don't think Flex really arrived on the Olympia stage after the 93 Olympia to be a threat for the title while Dorian was there. But I do believe that Nasser should have one. I think Kevin beat Dorian in 1995. I think I beat Dorian in 1994. And it's a coin toss in 96, just depending on how you look at it.
Yeah.
But again, that's me talking. Some people will take that and say, oh, I'm still whining about those years. I'm not whining. I was there. I was on the stage. I witnessed it. I lived it. I'm a fan. When I'm looking at the champion, if I can come up with all of these things that are wrong with him, then tell me what's wrong with me, and let's compare from there. So I fell out of like with bodybuilding along the way in the 90s, and it was easier for me to walk away when I saw what Ronnie Coleman was bringing to the stage in 2001.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I'm a big fan of Dorian's physique too. I mean, I think he's awesome, great bodybuilder. But if you go back to what bodybuilding's supposed to be, how can you give a title like the Mr. Olympia to someone who's got a torn muscle group? I mean, it's just kind of the ideal, you know?
Well, I mean, and Dorian's argument will be, look, Chris Dickerson won the Olympia with torn biceps. I think Chris tore his pec as well. I'm not sure, but it was a different. It was a different time. It was a different lineup. It was a different caliber of athletes he was standing next to. You know, Dorian, you got to give him props. His entire career, he was up against Hall of Fame bodybuilders. I was up against Hall of Fame bodybuilders.
Yeah.
But Dorian benefited from a judging system that was changing. The 90s, it was full blown, man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were, I think, starting after the 1990 drug test at Olympia. And a lot of people don't realize this. But Dorian could have done that 1990 Olympia. He lost to Benaziza at the Night of Champions.
Yeah.
In 1990. And Benaziza failed the steroid test in 1990 at the Olympia, which is why you didn't see him. He didn't choose to sit it out. He failed the steroid test. I just wanted to clarify that for some people wondering where Benaziza was, because I was looking for his ass.
I interviewed Dorian, and I asked him why he didn't do the 90 Olympia. And he said because of the drug testing, he didn't really know much about that. He didn't know how to pass it, so he just sat it up.
Well, I give him props. He did the right thing. It saved a lot of face. But, you know, for me, I was a bodybuilder first, right? I mean, either you got to adapt and adjust and do what you do to bodybuild. I wanted to be in the Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
So they got testing back before the show, and some people chose not to do it because of that. And I think Dorian was a benefactor by waiting for the 91 Olympia to roll around. Conserved notice to Lee Haney, and I wanted vengeance, so I went back to Columbus, Ohio, and exacted vengeance on that stage. I don't think Mike Asher was in the 91 Olympia, Arnold. I think he hurt his knee then.
Yeah, he wasn't, no.
But who was not in the 91 Olympia that should have been? I think everybody was there that signed up for it. Gaspari was there, right?
Yeah, yeah, he was like 10th.
Yeah, that was the beginning of his downfall. Gaspari was on the way out, because he'd been
he was fifth the year before when it was drug tested.
He was, I think he started getting injuries. Knock on wood, I never did get injured to any significance as a bodybuilder, and even in retirement. But I was a part of a revolutionary change in the 90s that we all bore witness to, and there's a reason we know who Gunther Sleerkamp is, and Marcus Rule, and Nasser El-Sambadi, and JP Fuchs, and even Greg Kovacs out of Canada. And I thought if they reward these looks, we will lose the smaller guys and the grace and the beauty would dissipate. And of course, on my departure in 2001, you know, we thought Dexter Jackson would carry the torch, and Melvin Anthony and Richard Jones. You know, there's always a new generation of bodybuilders coming in. The only thing that dissipated was the size quality, because you started having shorter guys that were bigger, but you didn't have bigger guys, right? I mean, Heidi Chupin is 5'6", but he's 245. And he's starting to get pretty boxy, right?
Yeah.
He's all boxy. What we did lose in the absence of the shapelier bodybuilder is the symmetry and the presentation. They're gone.
Yep.
I can't give you a name right now of somebody unless they're in classic physique. So now we're left with the best of what's left, And that's why I think it's easier to wind up with a guy like a Derek Lunsford over some of the other guys that there's a hodgepodge of muscle. Yeah, they're 285 on stage, but it's put together wrong. Presentation is gone. I think we don't see as many bodybuilders up there with muscle tears that we witnessed in the past, but we lost the symmetry. I think we lost the conditioning and we lost the presentation. And I think we're in a transition period right now, in the transition cycle, where we could wind up with potentially another 300-pound Mr. Olympia by virtue of nobody else standing next to him to equal him. Samson Douata, is that his last name? Douata.
Douata, yeah.
He's on an island on that Olympia stage. There's only one guy as tall as him, and that's Andrew Jack. And Andrew, for what it's worth, is a slimmer version.
Mm-hmm.
The legs aren't as prominent, but Samson in 2 weeks is going to show us who he is standing next to Hadi Chupin. It's going to be a sneak peek preview into what the Mr. Olympia is going to look like when Derek Lunsford stands on stage, because Derek and Hadi are now the Dorian Yates and Nasser El-Sambadi of 1996 when I was there. Dorian, I was second, and Nasser was third. It was a weird placing.
Yeah.
They corrected it in 97 by going Dorian, Nasser, and Ray. But I'm curious if they would go Derek, Samson, and Hadi. It stands to reason either Samson's going to be first or third with those two guys next to him.
Yeah, yeah.
So the pendulum can swing all the way back around because Samson's every bit of a mass monster.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At 6'1".
So do you think, Sean, do you think that the Mr. Olympia has been more competitive than in the past? In other words, in the sense that when I wrote for Weider, when I used to write my Mr. Olympia reports, I pointed out how the incumbent Mr. Olympia almost has a 10-point lead as soon as they open the curtains because he more or less sets the standard for the rest of the guys. So, you know, it's like the old saying in boxing, you can't decision the champion, you have to knock him out. In other words, unless the incumbent Mr. Olympia has declined in conditioning where it's noticeable, or some other guy has noticeably improved, the Mr. Olympia usually wins over and over, like Lee Haney did. So do you think that the way it is now with these guys, you know, being a little bit different, is it more competitive what we could possibly see, like a new Mr. Olympia every year?
That's what we're saying.
Or is it, in other words, is this the end of the era of the multi Mr. Olympia winning like Ryan
and
Lee Haney, 8-7, 8, you know, what do you think about that?
Well, again, and I always have to come back to myself and my own experience, right? When I left the Olympia stage in 2001, you're right. Mr. Olympia starts off with a 10-point lead. We got to chase him down.
Right.
Cutler, after prejudging, was leading by 4 or 6 points. Jay was, after prejudging, Jay was beating Ronnie Coleman. And Ronnie Coleman came back to win by the widest of margins. I'm not sure how that happened, but maybe because he started off with a 10-point lead, like you said. Today, and I haven't missed the Mr. Olympia since 1988, I could not take a $1 bill and put it on the reigning Mr. Olympia as a guarantee for victory. This is not a title that Derek Lunsford owns by any stretch of the imagination. The same way I didn't think Hadi the year before owned it. Mm-hmm. And before that, when Big Ramy was owning it, I don't think there's no one as dominant right now that can say that we can phone it in.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that way at the beginning of Ronnie's career, that he's going to be here for a long time. I felt, Jay Cutler, when he got there, I thought he's arrived. He'll be there for a long time. He got upset by Victor Martinez, who we didn't expect, or not Victor Martinez, but by Phil Heath, who we did not expect to arrive as quickly as he did. Phil matured very fast, and Phil came into the fray. Dexter Jackson caught Jay Cutler when he was off. I think Dexter will say, I didn't beat Jay Cutler. I caught him when he was off. I think that's what Dexter would agree to.
Yeah.
The same way that Jay says, you know, I didn't beat Ronnie Coleman. I caught Ronnie Coleman when he was off. This is a scenario going into this show, even though Derek is taking a full year to recover and Samson is out there doing the Arnold in 2 weeks and the Arnold in the UK in his backyard 2 weeks later. I think that works to Samson's advantage. He doesn't allow himself time to get too far away from competition weight, which he'll be able to train and mature his muscles better. He's a bigger bodybuilder. He needs to stay on his diet. He needs to stay closer to target rate. And I think he will understand the gravity of the situation, that he only has to win the Olympia one time to make history and be done. Derek, I believe, is a new father. Derek is experiencing what I predicted when he turned pro at the USA. I was interviewing him for Muscular Development magazine, that he'd be a future Olympia winner. Encouraged him to go into the open category where he got second. When he won, I was no surprise. I don't know that he believes that at his young age that he's at his best and he's reached his potential. Sometimes you can overtrain when you think that way. Samson Duata, because he's got much more volume like Ronnie Coleman, it's taking him longer to get, but he's arriving now. And when he arrives, he's going to be head and shoulders above the competition with Hadi and with Derek. He's going to be able to make significant improvements that we're not going to be able to see on Hadi and Derek because they're smaller. You didn't really see me and Librata and Benaziza. None of us really made improvements after about 5 years of being there that was significant. But on the bigger bodybuilder, you can see it, especially when they adjust their diets properly and they grow into their physique. And Samson is peaking at the right time. If I did have that dollar I wanted to bet on the Olympia, that's where I'd place my bet.
Hey, Sean, I wanted to ask you, you were talking about how what you suggested to D'Amelia changed the judging order, which I think I agree with you. I think that was a good idea, doing the mandatories first. But now it seems like they don't really do the relaxed round. They don't have a separate round for it anymore. And if you go way back to the 80s, they used to judge that round. They used to have three rounds of judging, and they had three scores, you know. So they don't really judge the symmetry. And like you said, the presentation, the posing, they don't judge that, except for the Arnold. So how important do you think that is? Because the way I look at bodybuilding is there's different aspects of a physique. It's not just the size and the condition. It's also symmetry. It's also proportion, the structure. And then I think the presentation is a thing on its own that's very important, that's kind of overlooked now. So how important do you think those two rounds are, the symmetry round and the posing round?
I mean, when I was competing, it was everything.
Yeah.
I mean, you have shape and symmetry or you don't. And that round should count for something. I think that the more things we take away from actually scoring a physique, the more we should get to the trophy presentation, because we know there's not going to be quality routines. We know there's no choreography. We know there's no entertainment value. So let's just come out and hit the mandatory poses and call pose down. That's where we're headed.
Yeah, I know. Well, it seems like that's how they're judging it now. They just go by the seven poses. They just go by those, and they're almost like scoring it like you would score a baseball game or a football game. It's like, well, he wins 5-2, or this guy wins 4-3 poses. But there's more to bodybuilding than that. There's symmetry, there's presentation, there's proportion. It's not just seven poses, you know?
Yeah, and I get into that conversation with historians. I get into those conversations with retired bodybuilders, because that's what we thought it was. And that's what it was. That's what made us passionate. But now the guys realize that it's all about the mandatory poses. They also know that they're up against a time constraint. They also know that they're standing on stage, you know, sometimes 20, 30 guys deep. So when you have that deep of a lineup, it seems like it's more rushed.
Yeah.
We don't have the time to see these individuals do the minute and a half solo prejudging routine. We don't have time for everyone to come out and hit their poses
because of all the divisions,
because of the divisions, the time constraints, and the time schedule. There's other things happening Olympia weekend.
Yeah,
that it seems like the Mr. Olympia, we got to get to it, and then you know, it's the last thing that happens, which is why we get out so late, and we're making more noise, and I'm hoping that they're listening to try to address that. I think the weekend of the Mr. Olympia, I think should start with the Mr. Olympia. Which means after you do your welcoming, after you do your acknowledgments, competitor number one from Egypt, John Doe. That's why we're there, right? And it's at the 7 o'clock hour, right? We're getting fed our main course at 7 o'clock, which is why we're there. And then have a round or two of a different division, come back and get your Mr. Olympia done with. And then you can have all the miscellaneous extra window dressing. And that way people that come for the meat and potatoes can get out of there at a regular hour and enjoy the weekend. I think holding them hostage to the end of the night, it's midnight. You lose a lot of your audience. You don't have the stamina. You, You get fatigued, eating. You get hungry. Being an older person now, my concentration levels wane, and by the time they're announcing the champion, I'm not that excited anymore. So I think they've got to find a way to put the genie back in the bottle, and speed things up a little bit, and really make the focus that when we crown Mr. Olympia, everyone is in the house watching it instead of going home and getting in my hotel room and looking for the results.
Well, that article I read about the 93 Olympia, it said the prejudging had, like, I think 15 comparisons for the mandatories and like 22 comparisons for the relaxed round.
A lot of work.
A lot of judging. They spent a lot of time at that prejudging. They really looked at, you know, calling up three people at a time, different judges offering, you know, they want this guy, this, they want this guy. So they really, really took their time and really looked at the physiques. And now, like you said, they just get right to the mandatory pose and there's no symmetry round. They don't do that anymore. They don't call comparisons for that. So it's over quick, you know.
When we get older, we know changes. We don't appreciate the changes. Sorry, I got an incoming call. I sent it to voicemail. Still here?
Yeah, you're good.
We oftentimes forget that we have to evolve with the times. The Olympia is a bigger, more lucrative, more inclusive production than it was in the early 90s, 93 especially. In 1993, I believe we only had men's bodybuilding, women's bodybuilding, and women's fitness.
That was it.
That's it. So we can give the athletes a better look. We can spend more time, and we can actually enjoy it. It's memorable. It's very vivid. But you go to the 2023 Olympia, and it's, you know, over a 3-4 day period when you count the amateurs and the size of the expo that was barely present in 1980, 1993. It is a production, and we have to adjust with it. I think the same can be said for when you watch the Super Bowl, right? The Super Bowl halftime production dwarfs the productions that they had back in the 80s and the 90s.
Yeah.
And the cost of a Super Bowl ticket. So the cost of the Olympia is daunting when you realize how much it costs to put that production on.
Yeah.
So there's pluses and minuses, good and bad. I think the older we get, the more nostalgic we get.
Now they want to add even more divisions. I saw somebody sent something to me about a men's wellness contest that was held in Brazil.
Yeah.
That's not part of the NPC though.
I still don't understand the point of the women's wellness. What is that being judged on? I mean, most of the women, they're very attractive women, don't get me wrong, and they're in good shape. It seems to be that they're judging them on their glutes. And my question is, what does that have to do with wellness? And that also begs the question, how do you judge a men's wellness contest? What would you be judging it on? You know,
well, I on a previous podcast that, you know, we have the Miss Universe contest, right?
Right.
They also have the Miss Universe trans contest. Oh. And if I didn't tell you it was trans, you might not know.
Right.
So right now we're living in a day and age where, you know, there's divisions for everyone. If it's not your thing, you don't have to change the channel, right? The IFBB is not behind men's wellness. I can tell you that on good authority.
Yeah.
The women's wellness, while some people don't understand it, it has given some longevity to girls that are fuller and thicker and more rounder and can't get down and slim as the bikini girls. If you look at our bikini champions, they're very thin. They're very dainty females. They're not that heavy. I mean, I don't know what they weigh, but I don't think many of them are more than 225 or 230 at the max. Some of our women's wellness, they're solid. They got some solid legs. They got solid glutes. They got shoulders. If you look at it in its totality, there's some girls that just can't get lean enough to be in a bikini. And if they do, they look like bodybuilders. So I'm not opposed to that. And it's very fit because they look healthier. They look fuller. They don't look so emaciated. That division's fine. If the men wellness ever caught fire, they're going to have to find a home for that. And I don't know that that's going to be here in the IFBB Pro League, but if they find enough competitors, they're going to have their show. And look, it's not a show that I'm going to buy a ticket to, but hey, to each his own.
Right.
Well, they had a picture of a person who won the men's wellness that was sent to me. And it kind of looked like what they described today as non-binary. In other words,
Yeah.
when you look at this photo, he was wearing what looked like a woman's bikini bottom, and the pose he was in is a typical pose that women would do. And I'm looking at the guy's face, the way his hair was. I said, this is one of these non-binary guys. I'm thinking maybe this is a contest, like you just mentioned, the trans Miss Universe. Maybe this division is for those people, and that's fine and dandy for them. I mean,
It's not gonna home in the IFBB Pro League. Jim
Right.
Mannion, they're not
Yeah.
interested.
I think it's
We're
just
like,
in Brazil.
yeah.
Port Jerry, we're seeing every. How long ago? Can you imagine in the 90s that you'd have a TRT company, giving you prescribed growth hormone or sponsoring a show? You can imagine driving down the street in the 90s and there's a marijuana shop on the corner and you can actually go buy a bowl. I mean, you have that. You have the teeth whitening. You have the hair restoration going on. You have the
Yeah.
BBL, the Brazilian butt lifts. I mean, everything goes right now. It's longevity. It's health and wellness. It's an influx of money that's coming into our industry for people that want to look and feel a different way. I mean, this is a sport where body dysmorphia is welcome, and it has a home. It has a home in our sport. And when you start talking about a men's wellness, it has a platform. I'm not surprised. They could have the Gay Mr. Universe contest. I don't necessarily want to go watch the Gay Mr. Universe, but I guarantee they'll probably have an audience for someone.
Wait a minute, sure, some of our best bodybuilding champions have been gay. You know that.
I
Chris
know. Here's the thing.
Yamada.
They like in like, listen, the NPC created a masters division, right, Jerry?
Yes.
Before they created that division, Albert Beckles, Vince Taylor, all those guys that compete, Dexter Jackson, they would have all been considered masters, but they didn't have a place to be the best older bodybuilder. They
Right.
created the Masters Olympia in 1994, Atlanta, Georgia.
Right.
Robbie Robinson, if they did not create the Masters, Robbie Robinson's not Mr. Olympia.
Right.
They did not create the Masters. Vince Taylor doesn't have six Sandow trophies as so they do evolve, they do create space when there's a demand for it. And while there was no demand for gay bodybuilders, they had only one place to go, IFBB, and we had some guys come in with some very good success. They could say, hey, I'm the best gay bodybuilder, even though I'm 13th in the Mr. Olympia. But there was no division for it.
Yeah.
And it was never one created. If it was created, they would have had plenty of athletes to fill up a lineup.
I'm sure they would. Yeah.
But they may not have been received properly, which is
Right.
why I think the wellness for men is going to be received properly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that 93 Olympia too, I should mention, that was the year that well, Lou Ferrigno came back the year before in 92, but in
Yes.
93 he was, I read in the article, he said he was 30 pounds heavier. It was 318 pounds in
Big Lou.
1993, and he made the
Yeah.
top 10.
So he made the comeback at 42 years old, I think it was in Helsinki, Finland.
Yeah.
He placed out of the top 10. I
Yeah.
think in 93, he wound up in 10th. And
Right.
then in 94, he did the Masters and wound up second to Robbie Robinson.
Yeah.
Lou was all over the news the way that Flex Wheeler was in the comeback. Joe gave him a 3-year contract. He got that because the WBF was going after him in 1991, 92. When he signed up for Joe Weider's Olympia, he chose the Helsinki Olympia and had a 3-year deal, which was a good
Yeah.
deal back then. It was rumored
Yeah.
to be $250,000 a year at the time.
Wow.
Wow.
Sean, speaking of the WBF, I'm sure they must have approached you, didn't they? I
They
mean,
know.
what was your reasoning? I mean, because they were offering big contracts, I remember, to a lot of the top pro bodybuilders back then. And most of the, a lot of the guys, top guys, went over to them, as you know. What was your reasoning to stay with the IFBB rather than to go in with the WBF and the big contracts?
So, I was getting ready for I came off the drug test at Arnold Classic, which I failed. I'm 60,000 in the hole, and I'm training for the 1990 Mr. Olympia, knowing it's drug tested, knowing they're going to get the results before I step on stage. In the interim, from March until I think it was maybe July, this is when the WBF is trying to formulate. Tom Platz sets up a flight for me to go on Grand Am Air out of LAX to Stamford, Connecticut, the
Right.
headquarters of WF.
Right.
And I meet with Vince McMahon. And he comes in briefly, but he pretty much put things in the hands of Tom Platz, who was running things. And they made me a 2-year offer. It was generous. It was 150,000 the first year and 175 the second year. I had a lot to think about because I didn't have any money at that time, and I was training for a contest. I didn't know if I was going to pass the drug test again.
And you just lost 60,000.
And I just lost 60,000. I had every reason to say yes. But in my economy, first of all, they want to own everything. Your 8x10s, your videos, your t-shirts. Oh. You couldn't make appearances. They're going to pay the $150, $175, but you can't do anything independently. And at the time, I was a very popular bodybuilder, right? I was very popular. I was on the cover of the magazines, and I had a very paltry contract with Joe. I think it was about $50,000 or $60,000. It wasn't much, but I wanted to be Mr. Olympia. And I thought, you know, this is a concept right now that they're talking to me about. It's not an organization that's in existence. There's nowhere for me to make appearances. There's nowhere for me to sell pictures. There's nowhere for me to have publicity. These are all concepts that I'm going to be on a talk show, a concept that I'm going to do this bodybuilding presentation that's not an actual contest. It sounded too far out there. I thought if it's going to last, they'll come get me down the road. I stayed the course, moved up from 13th to 3rd in the 1990 Mr. Olympia, where they launched that information. They broke the campaign in Chicago in 1990. I wasn't on board. I got third place. I won $18,000. I got a $20,000 raise from Joe Weider, but my mind was going straight to Columbus, Ohio. I got to go back in March to the 91 Arnold Classic and get that title and that check. So I didn't have time for Tom Platz, who was in the gym and would see me around. You ready to come? I'm thinking, I'm probably going to be the they get because Lee Haney's going nowhere. He just won again. Labrada just got second. He's definitely not going. And I just got third. It's going to be me and Labrada fighting it out for the next Mr. Olympia. I'm going nowhere. So I called Thomas. Look, man, I can't do it. I mean, the money sounds great, but I'm going to be Mr. Olympia. And I would retain the ability to travel the world and be my own marketing machine that way that we had. I wanted to go to FIBO in Germany. I had guest posing gigs, cash money. I just thought about what I was giving up to get this 150 grand that I thought I could make on the road. And most of it would be cash, non-reportable, non-taxable. And I would be global. I knew in my mind that the WBF was going to own Sean Ray. I was going to become a character. I was a bodybuilder. I was a performer. I didn't want to be a character. And they were only having one show a year. And I just thought, I'm going to lose all the media that comes with what I've just accomplished. And lo and behold, I won the Arnold Classic in 1991. It went from 60,000 to 70,000. That was half of what they were offering me. Joe Weider gave me a $20,000 raise. I'm at 90,000. Now I got all of these appearances I'm going to be making. I came out with the Sean Ray, I think it was one of my Lifestyles of Fit and Famous videos. I had posters. I had weight belts. I had a deal with a clothing company. I had a Sean Ray glove. I had five or six different sponsors because I was in the magazines.
Yeah.
And I was going on the Phil Donahue show as one of America's most eligible bachelors. All that would have been gone if I went with the WBF. And then Troy Zuccolato dropped the bomb. He said, they offered me 175 and 225. I said, wait a minute, you haven't even competed as a pro. As a matter of fact, your last win was in 1989 at the Nationals.
Yeah.
They're offering you more money than they're offering me. He said, yeah, I'm going to be the California surf guy, and Eddie Robinson's going to be the military guy, and they got Mike Christian and Tony Pearson's jet man, and Mike's – I'm going – I can't get with the characters. Number one, yeah. They offered $225,000. Troy had done nothing. He hadn't busted a grape. And I thought at that point in time, they could have it. I'm waiting to see what they're going to do with this show. Meanwhile, I got the Arnold Classic trophy in the check. I'm having dinner with Arnold and Maria, Tanya Knight. I'm sitting on top of the world. Lee Haney's going to, at the time, Lee Haney wasn't very good in Chicago in 1990.
Right.
So I'm expecting him to be off again in 91, but then we find out that they're no longer testing the Mr. Olympia.
Right.
And I go, holy crap, you're not testing? And I'm thinking that would have been working to my advantage.
Yeah.
And now this is Lee Haney's retirement party, and I'm in demand all over the country and around the world as the Arnold Classic winner. And, I'm not even thinking Dorian Yates because I forgot Muhammad bin Aziz beat him in 1990, and Dorian was the shadow. He wasn't publicized heavily. And of course, I got fifth place at that 91 Olympia. I think I made the right decision, Jerry, because I stayed true to what I fell in love with. I didn't become a character. I didn't get caught up in a gimmick. And I didn't disappear off the radar. And I didn't have to go through the political reinstatement. All the guys that came back had issues coming back from the WBF because they were told by Wayne D'Amelio, the dictator, if you leave, you're screwed. And no matter what you look like, I think Aaron Baker is the only one that came back with good significance. He beat Flex Wheeler at Ironman in 95. Gary Stratum had a good return at my show in 2007, years later, or 2006 when I put it on in, up there in Colorado. But yeah, none of the bodybuilders were the same. Gary Stratum was the only one that thrived. I think he's the only one that maybe didn't get drug tested. But I did the right thing by not going over there for my career.
Yeah, I remember then. I remember one of the Night of the Champions, John, we and I talked about this.
The last episode, yeah.
They set up graves on the stage.
For all the returning WWF competitors, yeah.
I said, went over to the – I wrote it – when I did the contest report, I thought – I wrote that that was in very bad taste. I didn't really like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like penalizing the guys, you know, where if they came back, they were saying, you're going to lose automatically. Don't even bother competing.
Yeah.
Well,
you're dead.
Well, to give context to it, the WBF got 13 guys. None of them were Olympia threat champions. Remember, Barry DeMay went over there with a torn pec and he never did anything.
Yeah.
None of them were a threat to the title of becoming Mr. Olympia. So they got the best of what was left. It didn't hurt the industry. It was one of, if we go through the history, that time, that period was one of the best things for bodybuilding when it actually happened.
It was.
Because Joe went a little further in his pocketbook. He realized that there's some vulnerabilities if he doesn't make things better for the Federation. And for Lee Haney, he signed a 5-year contract with Twin Labs before he won Olympia in 1991 for $1 million, which is $200,000 a year, which at the time was a lot of money for Lee Haney going into retirement. Yeah. And again, if you don't have the WBF, we don't have that spotlight on our industry. That created a lot of interest to our sport.
I even benefited. I mean, that's the only time Joe Weider gave me a raise. You know, it's like when the WBF started, I'd ask him for a little bit more money. He always kept, well, I can't do it, the budget, this and that. When the WBF started, he actually gave me, it wasn't a great raise, but it was a little bit more money for each of my articles. And he actually put me on the medical program, but I had to pay it myself, you know. But I'm kind of underscoring your point that a lot of people benefited because Joe saw a threat for the first time.
100%.
The man was a guy who actually had the money to do something, you know. But honestly, I knew it was going to fail. Like you pointed out, but the character thing about, and I went to both of those contests that they held, and I said, this isn't going to work. It's doomed to fail. I knew it. In fact, they actually, Fred Hanfrey was working for McMahon, recruiting some people. Remember, McMahon had a magazine also he tried to start. They wanted to come to Connecticut to interview, to work for the magazine. And what I said, I really had, after seeing the first contest, I had my doubts. I said, I don't know how long this is going to last. And if I burn my bridge with Joe, I'm done. You know, I'll never work for him again. You know, and I was getting along real well with Joe Weider, you know. So I said, I'll tell you what, I'll come to Connecticut if you guarantee me at least a 4 or 5 year contract. They said no. I said, I'm done. I'm not coming.
Well, I'm not sure how much money that experiment cost at that time, but it had to be pretty significant. I know Gary Stratum, Gary signed a 3-year deal for $400,000 a year. So he got $1.2 million out of it.
$400,000 a year. Wow. Yeah.
$400,000 for 3 years. And I just beaten Gary at the Ironman the year before, 1990. Yeah. I beat
him. Yeah.
So I couldn't get my head around, how are you going to give him $400,000 and you're offering me $175,000 and I'm on the magazine covers and I'm third in the Olympia. So the justification for me was warranted to not go. But for a lot of guys, it was, because they were going nowhere fast. I mean, Tony Pearson and Danny Padilla and a few other guys.
David Durst,
some of them only got $50,000. But at the time, they were getting nothing. Aaron Baker wasn't even under contract.
Yeah.
So $50,000 was better than what he was getting, so it was worth the exploration. Not to mention, some of the guys just had way too much time on their hands to do nothing with the money.
Mm-hmm.
So they got into partying and doing all kind of crap that they normally wouldn't do. It was something that was good for the sport of bodybuilding, and it was a large sum of money that I don't think they ever recuperated in the WBF. There was no revenue coming in for those guys, for the organization.
Right.
Sean, did they, when they were trying to recruit you, did they also say that they weren't going to do any drug testing? Because that was the year that the IFBB was right in the middle of doing drug testing. And I don't think anybody knew that they were going to stop the drug testing until maybe after the Olympia. But that's one of the things I read, was that they were saying to the guys, all the guys they were trying to get in the WBF, hey, we're not going to do any drug testing. You guys can get as big and freaky as you want.
That was never in my conversation because I
Okay.
shut him. You know, I got third in the Olympia, and I pretty much assumed I was going to be Mr. Olympia. I was 24 years, 25. I think I was 24 years old, and I was wide eyed. I was going to be the golden boy for Joe Weider, and I didn't care. I wasn't even talking about the drugs.
Okay.
I knew that they weren't going to score it the way a bodybuilding show's scored. It's going to be a show. I think they would have had legs had they done a television show out of this thing instead of trying to hold a live bodybuilding con. You can't call it a contest and there's no competition.
Right.
So it was a television show. It was like the Gladiators, and they should have gone that route and got the storylines behind the athletes at home, you
Yeah,
know,
that's a good idea.
like the journey to the gym, the obstacles, the family life, and then sold it to television. It might have been something more marketable
Yeah,
that
then
way,
they would
but
have built up like a fan base.
yeah. And I mean, and Tom Platz was, once he got his role over there, you couldn't talk to Tom. He was just, he cigar, and he, you know, you're dealing with a Hollywood producer. It's like, all right, forget it. You can't offer advice. I think best thing that happened was that Joe realized that there's a new sh sheriff in town, and he had to go in his pocket and pay some people what they were worth, and that helped.
John, I remember the story I told you where Joe brought me in the office right after the WBF started, when they started signing up guys. I was talking to Joe in his office. He says, "Jerry, you know what I'm going to do?" He says, "I'm going to give all the bodybuilders, I'm going to give them medical benefits. I'm going to pay if they want to go to college, blah, blah, blah. He's going to do all this." And then about as soon as the WBF disbanded, all of that went out the window. There was no more competition. He didn't have to pay any of that.
I tell you, Joe said a lot of what I think his heart wanted to do,
Yeah, I believe it.
but in hindsight, I think the practicality of it all, the generosity of it all, he couldn't take care of all the bodybuilders the way he wanted to. Like, he spent more money in places on our industry than he should have, and then he held back money in areas that we really needed it. For the healthcare situation, it would have been virtually impossible to create some healthcare plan for these bodybuilders, but it should have been a requirement for the Federation for these bodybuilders to show proof of healthcare before they pay for their pro card. You know, like, if you're going to be the IFBB Pro League, send in your health benefits that you have. We're not insuring, you're independent contractors. Like Ronnie Coleman, you could be a bodybuilder and a cop. You're drawing two checks, but you show us that you're healthy. You need to show us that you have insurance, or you can't be a member of the IFBB. Those mandatory points Joe probably should have implemented. I still think the IFBB is not responsible because these athletes are reckless. And it's a sport of Russian roulette for some athletes. These coaches are giving bodybuilders things sight unseen. Athletes are blindly following the lead of some other bodybuilder's protocol just because it works for them. So the Federation and Joe Weider could not assume that responsibility. But what they can do as a federation is require proof of health insurance, current health insurance, and proof of maybe a physical at the time we issue you your pro card. So we know you're healthy. When I played Pop Warner football, I had to get a physical before I could actually get my uniform. They had to know that I wasn't going in there, you know, with some pre-ailment. In bodybuilding, there's never been a doctor that talked to me ever as a requirement to do anything.
That's a
But
good point.
Sean, don't you think they should do that now? I mean, again, the bodybuilders are on their own. As you point out, they're independent contractors, but I guess this would be the responsibility of IFBB. Maybe ensure that the guys get regular medical examinations and at least prove that they're healthy going in, because the way it's going now, maybe you'll disagree with me, I think it's inevitable that we're going to see more serious illnesses and possibly deaths the way the guys are doing the drugs now. And I hate to say that, but it's almost inevitable from
Yeah,
what
well,
I.
I think the industry is not responsible for that because it is individual. Some of these athletes, irrespective of their health, are going to do things that compromise their health. I mean, you got bodybuilders competing with pacemakers. You got body competing with one kidney. Don Long was competing with no kidneys.
I remember that, yeah.
So while we look at some of these people in admiration for the things that they're overcoming, some of it's foolishness because, you know, your kidneys and dieting and protein and steroids. It's just a Molotov cocktail. It's an accident waiting to happen. And again, you can get a physical in January when you get your pro card, but if you're not competing until July, who's following that one athlete out of the thousands of members? But I do think that, you know, the simplest action would be send in your check for $200 for your IFBB Pro League card and send us proof of insurance. You know what I mean? Like, at least we know that you're insured and we can say, as a federation, they have insurance. If anything happens to them, we have their insurance. You know, they're on our stage. They're in our federation. We know who to contact if they fall sick in their hotel room. And those things do happen. So at least there's a little bit of protocol. And also the federation knows who you're insured by. And we also know that you're trying to, you know, cover yourself. Right now, there's nothing. You're from Egypt. You're from Iran. You're from Brazil. And we don't know who these people are. We don't know what kind of health situation they're dealing with.
Yeah.
I think you know where change comes from? Change comes from not death, but from lawsuits. So if I'm a parent and my son's found dead, and I'm going through his phone, and I'm going through his emails, and suddenly I see he's communicating with a coach that's telling him to take this, take that, I'm going to drag that person into a lawsuit. And I'm going to say, how did this come about? And what was my son into? And I'm going to find out that he's involved in a league and there's these shows all over the place. And this is what he's doing for this situation and on this date at this place for these people. And, you know, when a lawsuit comes, you change the way you do business.
Yeah,
but see, the problem with that, Sean, is that the coaches, and I've heard them actually say that, they don't force, whether it's the male or female, they don't force any of the athletes to take the drugs. They give them their suggestions, whether they're paid or not. That's a different issue. But the point is, it's the decision of the athlete. In other words, they're on their own. If you want to use the drugs that I'm telling you, then you're on your own. I'm not responsible. I'm not forcing you. That's their defense.
Yeah, but here's on the flip side. If you go into the bar and I give you a bunch of drinks and you get in your car and you drive off and you kill someone, I can come after that bar and say, look, you gave my son all this alcohol and he's driving. Yeah. You know, it can get messy when it gets into litigation.
Yeah. But
some level, at some point in time, there'll be a parent out there that's going to come for that guy who's going to point to the league, and the league's going to – everyone's going to have to lawyer up. But eventually that will happen. And, of course, the coach isn't telling them you have to take this or you have to take that. But, you know, the prostitute doesn't go looking for the John. The pimp tells them where the John is. Hey, he's over here at the Bellagio, room 241. That's how the prostitute knows to go there. So she's there on her own accord, but there's something in it for her. Right. Some of these coaches, you know, you got the pimps and the hoes, and it's a dirty business, man.
That's a good analogy.
You know what I found out a year ago? One of the baseball players for the Angels, he died taking fentanyl or something like that. Sorry, another voice call. He died on some drug overdose, and for one of the very first time, they prosecuted and persecuted the guy that provided the drugs. I think it was like one of the janitors on the team got on the drug. Athlete took the drugs. The athlete died, and they got the guy. So sometimes you can hold people responsible, but the parent that's frustrated, the parent that's in mourning and it's lost and maybe aware of what's going on, they will come for the federation or they will come for that guru at some point.
Yeah.
And you think that'll change the policy, Sean? You think that'll?
I think it always does. You know, you get street signs and you get stoplights put in places where they normally aren't after so many deaths occur.
It's true. You're right. Yeah.
So we're living in strange times where we're going to see some changes come if we keep going down that road. At some point, someone's line in the sand.
Right.
All right, guys. Well, I guess we'll wrap it up there. Sean, thank you very much for joining us on the show. It's always great to get your perspective, especially being at the 1993 Olympia. That was great, great stuff. And Jerry, thank you again. I think this is our last in-review show, Jerry, so we won't be doing this again for another year.
Another year. Well, let's hope we're all still here.
<Knock on wood. laughs> All right, guys. Pleasure growing old with you.
All right, guys. Take care. Thanks again.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye. Bye.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you again to Sean Ray and Jerry Branum for doing this episode, especially to Jerry, who has been with us now for, I think this was our 7th episode of our in review show. So I really appreciate all Jerry's time. Check out Jerry's newsletter at appliedmetabolics.com if you want to show him some love. It's only $10 a month if you want to apply to his newsletter. He really gives this huge newsletter every month. He works on it all month long. It's about 40 pages long. So check it out if you want to become a subscriber to Jerry's newsletter. And Sean also has some stuff in the works too. So I will announce that when it's all ready to be launched. But Sean is also doing some type of seminar that's online that he showed me a couple episodes of, and it's really, really good. So I will let you guys know about that as soon as that's released. All right. And I also want to, of course, thank our Patreon sponsors who continue to sponsor the Bodybuilding Legends podcast every month. I appreciate you guys. We could not do the show without you. All right, guys, before I let you go, let me read this article about the 1993 Mr. Olympia coverage. It was from the January issue of 1994 of Flex Magazine, and it was written by Peter McGuff. And it says, there was a new gasp, Dorian Yates, pushing physique standards beyond everyone's grasp, and then there were all the rest. Senior writer Peter McGuff presents a behind-the-scenes report about bodybuilding's all-time muscle blowout. The Gathering Shadow. Dorian Yates had never appeared so relaxed in the countdown to a contest. As he flexed in front of his hotel room mirror, it was impossible not to ask why. Hitting a wrist-clasped semi-most muscular, he responded, "You'd be freaking relaxed if you looked like this 2 days before the show." The defending Mr. Olympia stated that come Saturday, he would weigh 257 pounds, a full 15 pounds heavier than when he won the title in Helsinki a year previously. That's genuine pounds, not bullshit pounds that a lot of bodybuilders quote. Explaining the startling metamorphosis, Dawes, as his English brethren call him, said, "Knowing that Lee Haney would not be at last year's Olympia, I figured that my closest rivals would be Sean Ray and Vince Taylor, neither of whom weigh more than 210 pounds. I went for condition at the expense of size, over-dieted, and came in too light. This year, I've just concentrated on being the best I can be." In quieter moments, Yates confides that the reaction to his win by some sections of the bodybuilding community vexed him. Many wrote him off as a one-time Mr. Olympia. Proof of his simmering irritation was provided by a poster that adorned his gym in Birmingham, England. The poster's inscription read, 1993 Mr. Olympia, Atlanta. To all the disbelievers, kiss my ass. Yates may not have been thinking about his rivals, but the reverse was certainly not true. The leading contenders had heard the rumors of an unbelievable Yates guest posing in New York in July, and several of them, including Paul DeLette and Flex Wheeler, had a pre-Olympia sight of the photos of the 269-pound Yates that appeared in the December issue of Flex. At Thursday's press conference, there seemed to be a general mood of fatalism. Unless Yates had inexplicably screwed up in the last couple of weeks, the 1993 Mr. Olympia contest was for second place. A ray of ambition. One contender who sensed that air of resignation who among his peers but refused to embrace it was Sean Ray. The sport's most loquacious personality offered his assessment of the imminent conflict. Of the leading contenders, only two, myself and Dorian Yates, have had a 12-month contest-free run-in. The other guys have bit off more than they can chew by hoping to peak 6 months after their spring shows. Me and Dorian are like apples and oranges. There's absolutely no similarity between our physiques. What we have here is a revamped new attitude Sean Ray against a Dorian Yates who is bigger, which doesn't necessarily mean better. As a challenger, I concede no ground to Dorian. I'm ready to accept victory and defeat. I'm expecting victory, but wouldn't be shamed if defeat meant second. I'd be very disappointed with third. I respect Dorian Yates as a champion, but I'm going for the knockout. I think the title belongs in America, and I'm bringing it home. Mr. Consistency. Apart from Ron Love, Lee Labrada was the most experienced Olympia entrant on parade. Renowned as the consummate professional, the Houston resident was asked if his spring losses had fatally damaged his chances of winning the next day. He allowed only the comment that Flex Wheeler is an outstanding athlete before dealing with the defending champ. My physique and Dorian's differ greatly. The heavier and more massive physiques have been in vogue these last few years. So how does he keep motivated if he's battling against a trend he can't follow? I internalize my goals and stay motivated by achieving personal satisfaction from making consistent improvements. If I based everything on externals, like how a panel of 11 judges felt, then my motivation would eventually be deflated. Kevin Lavroni, Mark 1. One who knew all about motivation was 1992 Mr. O runner-up, Kevin Lavroni. In late January, he had ruptured his right pec, and although surgery had almost miraculously left virtually no trace of the injury, his convalescence meant that Lavroni, from a state of muscle atrophy, had only been granted 4 months to whip himself into shape. Many had advised Kevin to withdraw from the Atlanta showdown, the rationale being that he was asking too much of his drained body and that he ran the risk of forfeiting the reputation and ranking that he earned in 1992. Lounging in his hotel room, Lavrone explained why he had seemingly gambled with his career. To have people say, "Kevin, it's over for you," kind of lit a fire. It wasn't over for me, because I wasn't going to let it be over. He laughed before advising, "And hey, man, it gives you a better story to write about." And what a story beckoned when Kevin discarded his sweats to reveal a physique that would have been astonishing even if he had trained 12 months injury-free. His pecs were fuller and ripped, his traps were thicker, and his arms and legs were bigger, and just as cut as ever. At 240 pounds, he was 12 pounds heavier than his 1992 Olympia outing. How had he wrought such a change in such a short training period? God must have been watching over me, I guess. Did he think this shape was possible? I didn't know what was possible. I just knew I wasn't going to give up. Having induced a minor miracle, could he go all the way to the next day? I'm just going to go out to prove to everybody that, hey, I'm back. All I want is people to look at me and say, "Wow, that's amazing. That's success right there. I thank God that I'm even on the stage," because back at the end of January and right through to the end of March, my plans were to be sitting in the audience. So for me to go and talk about winning. Kevin disclosed that as an intro to his posing routine, he would play the taped telephone conversation that took place between his wife, Lolita, and his surgeon discussing his prognosis 2 days after the injury. It was dramatic stuff. But the next day, we would not hear the tape, nor see the physique that had been such a revelation that Friday evening. The flex man cometh. 1 hour before the biggest contest of his meteoric career, Flex Wheeler stretched outside his dressing room and confessed to being very, very nervous and scared. Getting into condition is easy. The hard thing is the waiting. It's the same with every show. I feel I've repeated my condition from the Arnold Schwarzenegger Classic while being a little bigger. It's the old school who says that you can't peak in the spring and then again in September. Like Lee Labrada says, if you're a professional, you can do it. As a pro, you need to compete and earn money. Asked to anticipate the upcoming affray, the man who had completely rewritten the IFBB record books by winning his first four pro shows ventured, "There's only two people I haven't been up against, Yates and Ray. I know they'll look crazy, but I feel really good about myself. To be here at my first attempt is a dream come true. I think I'll have failed if I don't get second. I'll have done great if I get first. I hope to God it'll be no less than third." Hulking misconceptions. Let me say it straight. I have the genetics of a thoroughbred cynic. So in the last 18 months, I wasn't one of those sucked into the midst of romanticism that surrounded the comeback of Lou Ferrigno. In the context of this Olympia report, the reasons aren't really important. Suffice to say they exist. Louis was able to turn my attitude around step by step, as will become clear. Our first exchange was in the dressing room he shared with Dorian Yates. As he asserted, "After having a further 12 months of training, I'm looking forward to the competition much more than I was last year when I made a lot of mistakes. It was like a case of stage fright. I hadn't given any exhibitions and I hadn't posed on stage for 17 years. At 318 pounds, I'm 30 pounds heavier. I think they'll be going for the beef today." After his 12th place of the previous year, what would now equate to success? "I've given 100% and now it's up to the judges. I'm more eager because I'm more secure and totally ready. I'm kind of looking forward to having fun." Contest? What contest? At 2:01 p.m., the 23 contenders from the 1993 Mr. Olympia contest rumbled out. The prejudging lasted an hour and 49 minutes and comprised 32 comparisons, 22 in the symmetry round and 10 in the muscularity round. Afterwards, Samir Banut spoke for the majority when he said, "Dorian Yates was first, second, and third." In truth, as soon as he walked out, it was clear that his blend of mass, proportions, and rock-solid condition would carry the day by a handy margin. On Yates' initial appearance at prejudging, the 4,000 who had assembled gasped in astonishment, their utterances running the gamut from "Jesus" to "You're a dinosaur, Yates." He was called forward for three comparisons in the symmetry round, and the single time he was asked to contest a muscular comparison, the opening one with Ray and Wheeler, was not at the behest of those holding a scorecard, As the round commenced, the judges had already seen enough of Yates to allot him an impregnable top spot. But judging coordinator Wayne D'Amelia made the call, figuring the crowd wanted to see the phenomenon flex again. During that unofficial spat, Wheeler and Ray vied with each other to hit each post first with the utmost gusto. Yates just took his time, and as he hit his front lat spread, he nodded his head in self-approval. That unscripted episode represented the only visibly aggressive tilt at the Yates tenancy of the Olympia throne, and eventually he was to earn straight first across the board. The Louis and Flavio Show. During the fourth comparison of the compulsory round, one of Lou Ferrigno's kids shouted, "Hi, Dad." In response, Louis blew back a barrage of kisses. More demonstrations of Louis's playfulness and the Ferrigno family in a loving mood were to come. The seventh call-out of the compulsory round involved Hamdullah Akdalung, Lou Ferrigno, and bodybuilding's most diminutive professional, the 4'10", 145-pound Flavio Baccanini. As he approached the center, Flavio ducked under Louis's outstretched arm and struck his striated thigh cheekily next to the giant's. Louis good-naturedly grabbed his tormentor in a headlock and ruffled the Italian's hair as the audience went crazy. Freed from the hold, Flavio challenged his adversary, who outweighed him by 163 pounds and outstatured him by 19 inches, to a devil takes the hindmost pose down. The pair went into a frantic muscle slugfest that brought the house down. This electrifying bout of spontaneity came to an end with Louis patting Flavio on top of his head, and the two, with difficulty, embraced as the auditorium filled with thunderous applause. Even the duo's fellow competitors clapped, and bloody hell, Dorian Yates smiled. Louis and Flavio's display was, Vince McMahon, please note, bodybuilding as show business. But what we witnessed was only the opening overture to the sport's latest sensation, the Ferrigno-Baccanini knockabout comedy act. In the evening, the twosome would repeat their antics, and it didn't take a rocket scientist to compute that there may be some mileage in the world's largest and smallest professional bodybuilders teaming up on a permanent basis. Dillette's dilemma. 2 weeks prior to his Atlanta assignment, Paul Dillette had endured an attack of extreme fatigue. He had vowed to come into the contest at 270 pounds, 9 pounds heavier than his Schwarzenegger classic form, and in pursuit of that goal, Paul was exploring his limits. The day before the contest, he began to feel unwell again, and after his first call-out, he had been forced to seek relief by sitting at the side of the stage. Following the prejudging, the giant Canadian, his size credentials were fully verified when he was compared with Ferrigno and achieved the impossible. He didn't look small. Gasped between breaths that he was tired, exhausted, glad it's over. Again, I had some problems on stage due to being too drastic in my preparation. I've depleted my body of sodium for so long I couldn't feel my muscles. I couldn't flex them. I tried putting in sodium all day yesterday, but it had no effect, which showed how depleted I was. Reviewing the 11 comparisons he was involved in, he reflected, "They always seem to work me pretty hard, but I guess it's better to be called out a lot instead of being ignored. I'm just going to have to learn to deal with it. I'm a professional, but my first ever competition was only 2 years ago. So in terms of experience, I'm still an amateur." Somewhat surprisingly, at the press conference, the likable Paul had stated, "I'm a new guy and still feel intimidated by all these names." If he can shed himself of that feeling and mobilize his enormous body parts into one refined package, he may be the only bodybuilder currently known who could compete with Yates on the basis of condition mass. Kevin Lavrone Mark II. It was a despondent Kevin Lavrone who trudged back to his dressing room. He had awoken that morning to find, as is so often the case in the modern world of bodybuilding, that the physique that had been so spectacular the night before had filled with water and smoothed out. The physique would still be good enough to finish fifth, but its owner had started the week with much higher hopes. In particular, he had wanted to place ahead, as he had done at the 91 Nationals, of Flex Wheeler. The twosome share a singular rivalry. "Standing out there, knowing I was off, depressed me," lamented the 92 runner-up. "But, like, what could I do? Ain't nothing I could do. I just wanted to get it over with." In that mood of resignation, he decided to abandon the planned playing of the phone conversation between his doctor and Lolita. "It would only have worked if I was at my best," he opined. "I feel I'm fighting for fifth place right now." In fact, he was fighting for fourth place as he finished only 2 points adrift of Lee Labrada. Lavrone may have gone away from the 93 Olympia with frustrated feelings of what might have been, but considering where he started from, Kevin Lavrone traveled further than any of his contemporaries. There was no bigger heart in Atlanta that weekend than the one that had beat inside the formerly damaged chest of the fifth-place finisher. Bodybuilding show of shows. After the damp squib of Helsinki, IFBB Pro Division Director Wayne D'Amelia had worked manfully to make the 1993 Mr. Olympia showdown a stunning success. As the muscle hordes assembled at the Atlanta Civic Auditorium for the evening's festivities, the fruits of D'Amelia and his associates' labors were clear to see. It was a night of superlatives, the largest crowd, over 5,000, ever to witness an Olympia contest, the best venue to ever play host to Joe Weider's brainchild, the most professional staging the event had been played out on, and the receipts, well over $600,000, amounted to the highest grossing figure ever. The total mood was one of expectancy. Could the 23 athletes reciprocate by providing bodybuilding's most nerve-tingling evening? They could. Platform dancers. Flex Wheeler executed a sassy finger-clicking routine complete with a couple of full splits, which made the women cheer and the men wince. Lou Ferrigno demonstrated the big difference between the Louis of 1992 and the 1993 version. While the previous year's model seemed as if he couldn't wait to get off the stage, the 1993 icon dominated it and had the audience in the palm of his massive hand. Turning to make a mock exit, he looked back and asked, "Do you want more?" The crowd shrieked in the affirmative. He cupped his hand to his ear in "I can't hear you" mode, and they made the prior acclaim seem as muted as the Dan Quayle for President movement. When Louis finally finished, sections of the audience were on their feet. Punching the air, he told them, "I love you." The feeling seemed to be mutual. To say that Flavio Baccanini presented a first-class posing routine is akin to saying the Pope is inclined to feelings of a religious nature. The Italian provided a tour de force that will be remembered forever by those lucky to witness it. At the conclusion of Flavio's extraordinary display, the auditorium's roof nearly lost connection with the walls. As sections of the audience stood, Corey Everson and Linda Murray waved their hands in the air, and Sergio Oliva, boy, could that cat dance, did the Arsenio Hall fist movement. All were witnessing the biggest audience response of the evening, possibly the most vociferous in the 29-year history of the Mr. Olympia contest. As Flavio said afterward, "I may not be the biggest bodybuilder in the world, but the audience made me feel like I was." And again, referring to the subject of size, his irrepressible nature queried, "Louis is more than double my body weight. Why don't they let me go on twice?" A huge roar greeted Dorian Yates as he strode out on stage. There's never been a better encapsulation of the Yates physique and presence than the one Flex editor-in-chief Larry Candilla coined in 1992. Brutal beauty. Yates's freaky music suited his freaky physique, but in reality, if he had posed to the sound of a dripping tap, everybody would still be transfixed. A spectating Lee Haney, who had previously become animated only in response to Baccanini, smiled as he watched his successor go through his paces. It was intriguing to speculate on the cause of his smile. Louis' song is sung. Lou Ferrigno was among the final 10 called on stage. He didn't have long to learn his fate. 10th place and a $5,000 check. The audience booed, but Louis seemed happy enough and quelled their disapproval with a most muscular. Once again, he told the throng, "I love you." But this time there seemed a touching finality about the whole tableau. Louis' constant companions throughout the day had been a camera team from Entertainment Tonight, a title that applied equally well to Louis' efforts. As he stood in line waiting the announcement of places 9 through 7, one saw a lump appear in Louis' throat. He seemed to be fighting back tears. Was he devastated or exhilarated by the result? A few minutes later, in the privacy of his dressing room, Louis reflected on what he had achieved. "I'm the 10th best bodybuilder in the world. That's some achievement." His wife Carla rushed into the room to quip, "You made $5,000. Where's the check?" Her petite figure wrapped itself around the 6'5" frame of her husband as she gushed, "I'm real proud of you. I get you back now. That's the best." It was all too much for Louis. Tears began to spill down his cheek. "I'm sad," he uttered in a soft voice. Viewing this poignant scene, your cynical scribe suddenly recognized the vulnerability and sensitivity of this huge man. Who was I to judge or criticize this bodybuilder who had helped make the 1993 Mr. Olympia unforgettable? Carla left, but even in his emotional state, Louis was willing to talk. After the first 10 minutes, I'd assessed the quality of these guys, and I knew I was going to place about 10th. Could he expand on his tearful state of a few moments ago? Carla and I went through a lot of pain and hardship in preparation for Helsinki, and after my disappointment there, I said, let me try one more year, and she went right along with me. So it made me very emotional because our family is very close, and when Carla said, I get you back now, it made me realize how much she'd sacrificed. But after this stunning performance, was his bodybuilding career truly over? I gave 100%, and there's no point in me sacrificing and asking my family to sacrifice another year just to come back and try to climb to 9th or 8th. From now on, I'll do exhibitions and appearances, but no contests. I don't want the pressure anymore. I'm happy to retire now. I'm from the 70s, and I've held my own with the great physiques of the 90s. Let these guys go on. They're freaking phenomenal, and I have to take my hat off to them. To have built this body at the age of 41 and to have surpassed all the physiques of my own era, the 70s, makes me very proud. Have a nice life, Louis. The final lap. The pose down to determine the final six placements lasted 3 minutes, and even though the winner wasn't in doubt, it was one of the most entertaining and physical in the contest history. During the fracas, Flex Wheeler and Kevin Lavroni indulged in their own private shootout, and Paul Dillette did the unthinkable. He hit a lat spread in front of Yates, momentarily hiding the champion from view. If that's an intimidated Dillette, the mind boggles at what his dauntless alter ego will attempt. Sixth and fifth places went to Dillette and Lavroni, respectively, while Labrada was awarded fourth. As had been standing throughout the day, a smattering of boos accompanied the announcement of Labrada's name. This ritual was presumably a consequence of him not always being super complimentary to Atlanta's favorite bodybuilding son, Lee Haney. For his part, Labrada was philosophical about the result. As he said after the show, I felt good that I achieved my personal best, and I also preserved and advanced my record. I've now been in the top four of the Olympia 7 consecutive times. The long embrace. Just about every placing from 10th upward had been booed, but a howling cacophony of derision greeted Sean Ray's third place announcement. He shared the crowd's consternation and almost staggered as he turned his back to the audience. For one fragile moment, it seemed as if he might walk off stage, and then Flex Wheeler intervened. Due to their conflict of 1993 Olympia interests, these bosom pals of a year ago had gradually seen less and less of each other, to the point that they hadn't even spoken for 10 weeks. Now Flex grabbed Sean around the shoulders and held him for what seemed an age. Above the hubbub, he barked into his captive's ear, you had me. They got it wrong. Keep your head. Don't walk off, okay? Satisfied that Sean was receptive to the advice, Flex let his despondent rival go. The incident spoke volumes for Flex Wheeler's character, as it did for Sean's, and that his buddy found himself caring that much about him. Flex was a busy dude during the award ceremonies. Having placated Sean, he turned his attention to Yates, and prior to second place being announced, held the reigning champ's hand aloft. As the official decision heralded him as a two-time Mr. Olympia, Dorian punched the air, and as his wife Debbie ran on stage to hug the champ, Lee Haney stood to applaud the pageant spread before him. Backstage, Flex exclaimed, oh, Jesus, Dorian was untouchable, completely. Sean was in incredible shape, and we felt he'd edge me out during the first two rounds. We went back to the hotel knowing I'd have to come out with an excellent posing routine to pull back some points. My heart goes out to Sean, because once again, he's gotten into his best ever shape and still didn't get the placing that he wanted. I told him on stage I thought he had second. God, yes. I was shocked by the way he looked. Kevin was the one expected to be battling for third spot. I realized I wasn't going to win after the first round. The callouts went his, Dorian's, way, and I just kissed the title goodbye right there. Dorian was heavier, bigger, and fuller, but not as sharp. No excuses when I say this, but I peaked on Friday. But even at that peak, I couldn't have handled Dorian today. He was a mule in shape. Sean Ray is the most accessible bodybuilder there is, and in the wake of previous disappointments, he's never run for cover. But on this occasion, he just threw on his clothes, grabbed his training bag, and made for a secluded side exit. I followed him, knowing he was aware of my presence. Normally, he would have acknowledged me, but he strode on until I shouted after him, asking him if he'd answer a couple of questions. He hesitated for a moment and then turned on his heel to present me with a face so contorted with anger that it didn't really look like Sean Ray. Okay, he rasped, his eyes boring into me like lasers. He wasn't being discourteous. It was obvious he was hurting. Given the circumstances, my opening line of "How do you feel?" didn't qualify for the Diplomat of the Year award. "Like shit," he almost snarled. "2 years in a row. I won't be back in 94. You can put that in black and white. Until somebody tells me what I got to do muscle-wise, condition-wise, attitude-wise, and posing-wise, I definitely won't have any reason to go into the gym. I'm not going to die trying to become Mr. Olympia. I can concede defeat to Dorian Yates by virtue of size, but I should have been no less than second. Flex told me he thought I was second. When another competitor can say that in the heat of the battle, I tip my hat to him. That was sportsmanship and friendship coming from Flex Wheeler. But he couldn't step down and give me another 20 grand in his placing. If a highly motivated Flex Wheeler can concede defeat to me, then what the heck is it that the judges aren't seeing?" Having detached himself from an avalanche of well-wishers, Dorian Yates retreated to the sanctuary of his dressing room and explained what the day had meant to him. "Quite honestly, my goal this year was to achieve something not only for myself, but for the sport as a whole. I wanted to set a new standard for competitive bodybuilding. People told me I could have been bigger and still have been tight enough to win, but I wanted to present the whole package: size, muscularity, proportion, condition. From the feedback I've been getting today from a variety of sources, I think I've achieved my goal. My current mindset as a competitive bodybuilder, and I'm not a gym bodybuilder, is to now see how far I can take this, how big, muscular, and hard I can get. I'm focused entirely on how good this physique can be, not how good it has to be to win, but how good it can be irrespective of the opposition." With the second Sandow in his keeping, did he have an eye on Lee Haney's record? What Lee Haney achieved was unbelievable, and I refuse to look that far ahead. All I can say is that I will be back to defend my title in 1994 with a physique much improved from this one, a physique that I hope will be judged, once again, the best anyone's seen up to that moment in time. The general consensus seems to be that the Olympia title can be Yates's for as long as he wants it. Such talk of a new Mr. September elicits comparisons with the past master, Lee Haney. Interestingly enough, a source close to the awesome one confided that he's glad his friend was no longer competing, as he would hate to see the 8-time Mr. Olympia lose. Time to seek out the man himself. "No doubt about it, Dorian was the winner," drawled bodybuilding's most distinctive voice. "He's gotten bigger with even more muscularity and detail. Fantastic. Out of sight. You know, he was over and beyond a champion. He knows his body. It'll be hard for anyone to unseat him." "Even history's best, Lee Haney?" "I'm not going to talk about me. Let Dorian and his family have this moment. This is his time." Prophetic words, perhaps, from one who has been there and stayed there towards another who is now there and threatening to stay there. Postscript: at 1 a.m. Sunday morning, as Dorian Yates celebrated his victory at the International House of Pancakes, there was no room for him at the official banquet. Flex Wheeler remained tucked up in his hotel room as Sean Ray sunk a couple of beers to drown his sorrows, and as Lou Ferrigno contemplated retirement in the bosom of his family, Flavio Baccanini was still besieged at the Atlanta Civic Auditorium signing autographs. You don't measure star quality in inches. And the final results: Dorian Yates from England first, $100,000 first prize. Flex Wheeler, USA, second, $50,000. Sean Ray third, $30,000. Lee Labrada fourth, $25,000. Kevin Lavroni fifth, $17,000. Paul Dillette from Canada sixth, $12,000. Charles Claremont from Barbados seventh with $8,000. Sonny Schmidt from Australia eighth with $7,000. Andreas Munzer from Austria, ninth and with $6,000. And Lou Ferrigno from the USA in 10th with $5,000. 11th went to Milo Sarsev. 12th, J.J. Marsh. 13th, Flavio Baccanini. 14th, Ron Love. 15th, Ray McNeil. And the following competitors tied for 16th, meaning they weren't placed: Hamdullah Akdalung from Turkey, Arthur Berman from Holland, Andre Charette from Canada, Pavel Gromulis from Czech Republic, Mike Matarazzo from the USA, Mauro Sarni from Italy, Johann Schnatz from Austria, and John Sherman from the USA. All competitors placed 11th and below shared $15,000 or $1,154 each. Total prize money, $275,000. All right. Great article. Peter McGuff. We miss Peter McGuff. He was a great writer. All right, guys, that's it for this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. We will hopefully be back next week with either another interview on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, or maybe I'll read some old magazine articles. Until then, stay safe, train hard, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.